This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
City Limits. Brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9am.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment.
To transport and planning and housing issues.
To privatisations and our utility services.
To building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
Okay, I'll clear the throat so they might come on, so I cleared the throat again. And it's City Limits. It's the third Wednesday of the month. Therefore, it's housing today.
Housing, as I know well.
Yes, that's right. And Maxwell over there knows well. I'm Kevin Healy, and today we're going to be talking to one of our regulars in Shane McGrath from the Housing with the Aged Action Group. But unfortunately, Jack Burden, one of our other regulars, is unavailable this month. He'll be back next month, I believe. So we're going to talk to Kate Shaw instead, which is a good replacement anyway, an excellent
chat.
Replacement.
Yep.
Kate, of course, a geographer and at Melbourne and academic who's done a lot of work on housing, and we'll talk to her about lots of things to do with affordability and non-affordability and why it's not affordable and all that sort of stuff.
I look forward to that in
yeah.
the hour.
Now, I've just realised another thing. Hang on a tick. Look, I'll pour some tea first.
We've got to get ourselves sorted.
We're getting our organised here this morning. We're totally disorganised.
Tea's the priority around here at City Limits.
Now, we'll just pour some tea into these cups. Oh. These don't be a mug, join the union, or one with sort of flowers and pink. You've got
flowers.
That sort of choice today, Anne. What's the go?
Oh, look, I'm going to have to leave you with the flowers, Kevin.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. So I'm the mug.
I'm the mug. What kind of tea are we drinking today?
We're drinking Vietnamese green tea today.
Nice.
And I've just realised that I hadn't taken my glasses out of the bag. That's what I was about to say.
The other thing.
It's made it very difficult to do anything on this program without my glasses.
Well, we were just talking about the weather earlier. I will continue the weather conversation.
Yeah.
Which is, I'm so glad that every now and then you get nice weather in this era of global warming. So, you know, we've got the few days, the few mornings here and there. So we did dawdle in today a bit, I think.
We did, I think. It was a pleasant ride across, I must admit, from Brunswick to here. Except, and I was thinking coming up Smith Street, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a theory that all these sci-fi books trying to work out about invisibility and people being invisible, but scientists have never ever worked it out. But I've always said the one way to make sure you achieve invisibility
is to ride a bike.
Ride a push bike on a main road.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. And this morning was a good example of that. I think motorists had no idea that I existed or was present.
Wow.
Most of the time. So it was morning and being very careful riding a bike, let me tell you.
So you reckon you had a few close calls there this morning?
A couple of close ones, yeah.
They
just
good.
Ignore you totally. Now, look, speaking of climate change, some of our great resource people, the Minerals Council of Australia, has been putting ads in the paper this week. I rather think they're reacting.
Oh.
Because we mentioned last week that some bodies have been suggesting that maybe it should be polluter pays and there should be taxes on pollution and, all that sort of stuff, which is bloody terrible when you think about it,
Oh, yes, you've got to feel sorry for them.
That's right. Well, they're currently running ads saying Australian mining pays enough tax to fund Medicare.
Yes. You know, that's a meme. I've heard that one so many times.
Right.
If you repeat it often enough, it'll become
according
true.
To the latest government, et cetera, they go on about. That's the difference. Australian mining makes. Minerals Council of Australia. Now, all very well. What they don't tell us is what profit they make, of course.
Mm.
What that tax, mining tax, whatever it is as a percentage of their profits.
Mm.
And also, of course, whether any of that goes toward the pollution they cause. none of those things.
Pollution which would cause health problems, which is why we need good
health. The health thing, that Medicare, that's right. I've got a bit of a cough this morning. It's pretty awful. But anyway, the other factor is that the Australia Institute's also put out figures showing that that uni students pay more in debts to the government than the mining company does. Mining companies do anyway. But that doesn't come into their ad, by the way.
Wasn't it in the fine print there?
Wasn't there. So, in fact, they're so good. It's enough to fund Medicare so people can see a GP, visit a specialist or get a scan without paying the full cost on their own. So that's what mining does. Isn't it wonderful?
Well, you know, I have to jump in with my modern monetary theory comment there and say, their taxes pay for nothing. That's not how taxes work, people. Federal taxes pay for nothing. But that doesn't mean we don't tax them, because we need to tax them out of existence, basically.
Well, that would be a terrible thing. That would get rid of capitalism.
Mm.
Think of that.
Oh. Can we tax capitalism out of existence, Kevin? There's a thought.
We could certainly try.
Swallow its own tail.
Now, here's an interesting point. There's been this furor about parliamentary expenses. And Sarah Hanson-Young, Green Senator from South Australia, and just find this one interesting, because she spent about $50,000 to fly her husband to Canberra regularly.
I remember you mentioning this.
Mention this, did I? Mm.
Go on.
Well, I might have mentioned it last week. I didn't think I did. Which means that...
This is the hubby that works for...
that's it. Well, I must have mentioned it last week, but the husband works for Rio Tinto. Now, that's right, because you did say, make for interesting breakfast conversation, and I used that line in the week that was this week, so you got
a line out of me.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm worth a line. But we should remind people if they weren't listening last week.
Well, it is interesting that her husband, and she's got every right to, it's under the rules they have family reunion stuff, so you can fly your partner up and all that sort of stuff.
Rightio.
But he does work in Canberra as a lobbyist, so she's spending money getting him back to work, basically.
Right.
But also one of his clients in his lobby company is Rio Tinto, which is one of the biggest polluters in the place, which I find interesting from a Green senator, that's all. And you said it must make for an interesting breakfast conversation.
That's right.
Yeah. So there. Now, it's been estimated that it will cost something like $70 billion. The UN World Bank Act, the UN, the World Bank and the European Union estimate the reconstruction of Gaza will cost $70 billion US, which is close to 100 Australian, I suspect.
Mm-hmm.
100 billion, that's a lot of bloody money.
Yeah.
But Donald's border piece is going to sort it all out, so that's good to know.
Mm-hmm.
And in his usual way, Donald said that the border piece is probably the most important thing that's ever happened in the world.
Whatever's going on within 3 feet of him is the most important thing in the world.
But that's right. But anyway, this is probably the most important thing ever since the start of time. World of peace. Yeah, that's right. So
bigger than Jesus, huh?
Yeah. So far, I think he's raised $5 billion, by the way, so he's still a bit short. But he'll sort it out.
Mm. I'm sure he will.
Yeah.
He'll sell a few crypto coins or something.
And of course, it's not finished yet, because Israel's still bombing the place anyway and still killing people. So
no amount of money is going to bring back those died.
No, unfortunately. Mm. And there was a very good interview earlier this morning on Radio National.
Okay.
With the bloke, his name I forget, but the bloke who made that film last year that won the Academy Award for Documentary, which was based on the treatment of the people of the West Bank by Israel. And he said he knew that one film wouldn't change things, but he thought it might start people to start to think in the world do something about it. Mm. But since he got back, all that's happened is he's been bashed up regularly by the settlers, arrested by the Israeli army, and attacked. And now with these new rules that Israel is bringing in about land rights, he says he's in great danger of losing his home altogether and everything else. And so, you know, it's just turned into utter misery for him. And he, because he made this film exposing them, they just...
Right, they're really getting stuck
into
him.
Getting stuck into him. Mm. Poor man. And again, that we know that Israel, you know, it's interesting in the Middle East when you hear about, generally speaking, it's either Israel invading Gaza, which it has, or Israel attacking people in the West Bank, or Israel attacking Syria, or Israel attacking Lebanon, or Israel attacking Qatar. But, you know, it's Israel, 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 which which make you think what may be the problem in the area. But it's the other countries, obviously, that they're forced to attack. But, again, they've struck Lebanon near the Syrian border and killed four people again in the last couple of days. Mm. And despite the truce that goes back to November 2024, Israel has kept up regular strikes on Lebanon. It appeared to be the first strike Israel has claimed on Lebanon against Islamic Jihad. But an Israeli drone targeted a car on the Lebanese-Syrian border, the state-run National News Agency said, adding that four bodies were inside the vehicle. Mm. Fighters from Islamic Jihad were among those killed in Lebanon during hostilities, etc., etc. But it just goes on and on.
Goes on and on. Yeah, speaking of Israel, I heard the other day someone was mentioning the vote at the UN to lift the sanctions on Cuba. And there were two countries that voted against. One of them was the USA.
And the other one was...
Israel.
Yeah, well, but did Australia...
No, I thought Australia would be in there, but didn't get a mention.
we may well have just... Oh, was on the Security Council, though?
Probably. And I don't think it was the last... It was the previous Trump era they were talking about.
Oh, I see. obviously, often Australia abstains on those sort of things and just...
Oh, they didn't mention the abstains.
Proves to be totally gutless, but it may well have been a Security Council we weren't even on, so... We'll let them off on that one.
No, it wasn't. It was the whole thing because they said 100 and whatever countries. Yeah.
Now, Grace Tame, former Australian of the Year, who, as we know, was named because of her role in taking on sexual abuse.
Yes.
And but she spoke at an International Women's Day event. About what's happening in Israel, and used the phrase "globalize the Intifada," which has the Israeli lobby, the Zionist lobby, up in arms, screaming and yelling. And there's been letters in the paper saying she must be stripped of her Australian thing, and she not to be. She spoke at the Sydney rally. I'm sorry, I've confused that. We're having a confused morning, aren't we?
She spoke
at the. At the Sydney rally, but then she is scheduled to speak at the Bendigo International Women's Day event coming up.
Right, I was going to say Women's Day is March, isn't
that's
it?
That's right, March 8th. And so she, and now they're screaming that she must be taken off the speaker's list because she's so damaging. And there was a letter in the, an article, in fact, in the Financial Review by a Zionist, again, making all those points about how terrible it was and she has to be stripped of her title and all those things. But a very good letter turned up from a bloke called Jeffrey Lowenstein from Brighton East, who one assumes is also a Jewish person. And he says, this is in the Fin Review yesterday, I think, leaving to one side whether one questions the various propositions and contentions on the op-ed piece, I'm a Jewish woman, I want Grace Tame's Australian of the Year cancelled, it would be more than interesting to know whether the writer and her organisation have done or taken any affirmative action relating to the deaths, maiming and starvation of children and women flowing from Israelis' actions in the bombing of Gaza and the restrictions imposed by Israel on food, medicines and medical supplies entering Gaza. I suspect not.
Excellent response.
Yes, quite a good little letter, really.
Yeah,
I thought.
Pointed.
Now, the Victorian Land Registry was privatised
Yes. What was that? I remember hearing that discussion and thinking, this is like, this is privatising our ability to know who owns what piece of land.
That was privatised, as was the motor registration, a lot of the aspects of that. Government got money, and of course, once you get that money, well, you get no more.
Yes, you still need to know who owns right. which bit of land.
When you own it, you get the money every year that comes in from it.
Yes,
but anyway, you'll be surprised to know that there was an article just the other day saying that the fees have surged since it was privatised. Yes, that does come as a hell of a surprise, doesn't it? But so much so. that the old Macquarie Bank, one of our very favourites, as offshoot of Macquarie Asset Management, they're negotiating to buy a 50% stake in the company, a mob called Secure Electric Registries Victoria, SERV, is sort of aware of it, and Aware Super is also heavily involved. And they expect... they expect to get $4 billion for the for flogging it. $4 billion, for which they paid when it was privatised in 2018, they paid $2.86 billion. So that's a $1.4 billion profit in a few years.
A few years. That's a good flip.
flogging what was public property. Which I find just
the classic
really
privatisation story. Sell it for what less than it's worth, and just let the user have to deal with whatever these for profit people are going to do with it.
Yes, that's about it. In a nutshell, yeah, that's the situation.
And are they even going to keep their databases accurate? Who knows?
Oh, pardon.
Let us not suggest.
I hope you're not suggesting. Yeah, that's right. I'm going to top up my tea. And you want a bit more tea? Or you're right there.
No, I'm good, actually. Okay. It's a good tea today.
I'm glad you topped it because I think I just ran out of it.
Yeah.
But anyway,
okay. You must have drunk a whole pot over there.
No. I just two cups. But anyway, there you are. Have another sip. Now, the papers that came out, which come out around New Year, show that. Back in 19-whatever, when John Howard was the Prime Minister...
Oh, that is 19-whatever.
Yes. The government was given warnings by the Bureau of Meteorology and also Australian National University climate people about the dangers back then... This is two decades ago, the dangers back then of climate change. And they made the point that a previously unreleased briefing on global warming to the Howard government issued a stark climate change, but even this frank advice failed to anticipate the extreme heat and catastrophic bushfire conditions that swept the eastern seaboard just this week. Newly released cabinet papers prepared, etc., were largely ignored by the Howard government, despite advice to ministers that the global average temperature rise was unprecedented in human history. ANU Professor of Climate Science Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick recommended the briefing for incorporating contemporary scientific advice from the Bureau of Meteorology, but said even this undercooked the alarming rise of Australian heating in the past 20 years. The briefing said global warming would spur increasing heat waves, droughts, fires and sea level rise, which was a result of rising levels of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that was in part attributable to human activity. Well, I think it's more than that. More than in part. There's a very close link between the increasing global temperatures and all this warning, and yet the Howard government just totally ignored it and in fact went further, because Australia signed the Kyoto Protocol in 1998, which was one of the first attempts to try and do something about it worldwide. But ultimately chose not to ratify it under the coalition government led by John Howard, citing potential economic disadvantage compared with major emitters such as the US and China. So it wasn't economic to stop destroying the planet. But it was ratified on December 3, 2007, on the day the Rudd government was sworn in to succeed Howard. But
know the problem with all this, Kevin?
Which shows what we know what a terrible person he, what a terrible Prime Minister he was, but, you know.
That reveals.
Well, I think we also knew, because we knew he wouldn't ratify, and we all knew at the time. And it's interesting that they did get that sort of information. And yet, with all that information at their fingertips, totally ignored it.
Still not. Yeah, I was going to say, you know what the problem with all of that is, though?
No, I don't. I've got an idea.
Tell you what the problem is, Kevin.
Yeah.
There is no satisfaction in saying, I told you so.
No.
That's the problem.
No, that's right. That's right. There is no satisfaction in saying, I told you so.
But here we are.
Yeah, well, things are getting worse, because we've now got a government that says it's doing it but isn't.
That's right. And I don't know which is worse, actually, the obvious one or the two-faced one.
Good question. Good question. Anyway, look, we'll go to Shane McGrath and talk about other matters.
All righty, Shane McGrath coming up. In the meantime, here's Carsey Blenton with Rich People.
Seem like bad news all of the time. We got floods and fires and wars and crime. They try to tell me who I ought to blame, but I know who it is, 'cause it's always the same. But don't be ashamed if you get confused when you talk to your friends or you watch the news. They try to tell you where it all went wrong, and you don't need to argue, just sing this song. It was rich people stacking the deck, rich people with big fat checks, rich people having a ball, rich people been f***ing us all. But they laid me off last Thursday night. They tried to tell me where the money went, but I know who it was pinching every cent. It was rich people stacking the deck, rich people with big fat checks, rich people, they're having a ball, rich people just f***ing us all. Now you know the important words. Rich people, it ain't the Jews. Rich people don't pay no dues. Rich people, it ain't the blacks. Rich people don't pay no taxes. Rich people, it ain't immigration. It's rich people and corporations. Rich people, it ain't rednecks. It's rich people with big fat checks. Rich people, they're having a ball. Rich people been f***ing us all.
Okay, and that was Rich People. And speaking of rich people, we've got Shane McGrath on the line from the Housing with Aged Action Group.
He's a rich person, is he?
Oh, very, very. He's rich in knowledge.
Yes.
which we hope he's about to give us. Shane, of course, is from the Housing with Aged Action Group, a regular on this program. And Shane, well, sort of Happy New Year in a sense, because this is our first housing program for the year. But items you want to raise today?
There's a few things to talk about. Herald Sun had a great article the other day. I don't know if you've got it ripped out there in front of you, about a couple desperate to evict a tenant let down by Victorian laws. That's the landlord who's let down by Victorian laws, not the tenant they're desperate to evict.
Yes.
It's a terribly sad story. They are very aggrieved that the renter has agreed to pay back the arrears that they owe. They don't want that. They just want them out. I thought that was a pretty funny story. You would think the Herald Sun would be happy that the landlord was getting their money, but no, they just want to be able to throw out anyone they want.
Well, that's right. I mean, if people get behind, it shows that they're just irresponsible, doesn't it? Not that they're broke.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of problems with the Victorian rental laws, but the system is set up to try and make the renter pay the landlord the money that's owed. Like, the tribunal would much rather the landlord gets their money than the landlord doesn't get their money and someone's homeless. Like, it's like, you know, it's clearly better that both those things happen. The landlord gets the money and the tenant gets to stay, than the landlord gets no money and the tenant's thrown out on the street. But the Herald Sun didn't see it that way, surprisingly enough.
Well, Rupert Murdoch's often in trouble, of course, trying to find somewhere to, you know, put his head down for the night as well. So he understands these things.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right.
Absolutely. Yep. Else?
I was thinking, you know, we don't really talk very much on your show about, like, individual cases that we haven't had, but we have one this week that was sort of memorable enough that I thought I might mention it. It's the first time that we've gone to VCAT to try and... Well, the orders that we were looking for is that the renter should be allowed to pay rent. The background to that was that this guy lives in a caravan park. Part of the caravan park is on Crown land. You're not allowed to rent out a site on Crown land permanently anymore. That law changed a few years back. This guy lived there before that, but the caravan park didn't do the proper, you know, permitting process for him to be allowed to stay. They've been trying to get rid of him, including refusing to accept his rent, which obviously at a certain point is going to become a problem. So we had to apply to VCAT for orders that he is allowed to pay rent for his site. And it was one of the shortest VCAT hearings we've ever had, because there's not really an argument that he shouldn't be allowed to pay rent for his caravan park place. And so, yeah, we secured his right to stay. He's now paid his back rent, and we're really happy that we could sort that out for him. And really, for the park, again, it's these surprising number of landlords who don't want to get the rent they're owed.
Yes, that's right. And not surprising, the numbers who want to keep putting it up all the time. On the other hand, okay, through the break, of course, we've had this this item come out, more than an item, the fact that the government's going to demolish now some elderly citizens units, and Fiona from your organisation was pretty prominent in talking about it. But can you talk about that one a bit to us?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm sure listeners know that the Victorian government has this program to demolish all of the public housing towers in the Melbourne metro area. We had understood that their intention was to do the older person public housing last, which has a logic to it because, you know, relocating people out of the towers is quite, you know, difficult. It costs a lot of money. It's challenging, all of those things. And, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, if you leave the older people's towers to last, a lot of those people will pass away in the interim and you won't have to relocate them. So there would be a logic to saving them up. But for whatever reason, they didn't do that. They changed their mind, or maybe that was never really the plan. And so, yeah, they've announced that the next sort of tranche of demolitions will be some of the older person's public housing towers, where we have, you know, members and former clients and so forth. So HAG put out a statement with some other community organisations, VCOS, Tenants Victoria, Council of Homeless Persons, et cetera, calling on the government to do a series of things, including actually protect the idea of, not just the idea, the reality of older persons' public housing, because there was talk that, you know, when people went back, it wouldn't be older people's housing anymore, that there might be older people's floors on general public or community housing towers, which, you know, would be a real loss. That is a model we see in some of the other community housing developments now, that there are floors of the building set aside for older people, which isn't really what anyone is looking for. It manages to combine, you know, the isolation of a little ghetto with, you know, the lack of security of having everyone in the building. The minister and the CEO of Homes Victoria were receptive to those requests. Fiona and others got to present the list of, I mean, demand's not the word, but the list of things that we think the government needs to do to make this as best it can be. But, yeah, that's basically what's been happening.
So is there any hope of saving them all together at this stage or not?
Well, I think the hope of saving them altogether is still with the Inner Melbourne Community Legal Centre legal challenge, which is working its way through the courts to the whole sort of process of demolition generally, and the very brave public tenants who have been part of that process.
And, of course, many of these people have been in these places for a long, long time, so disrupting them at this stage of their life is from their point of view, quite awful.
Yeah, I mean, people can be connected to local services. One of the big advantages of having a lot of, you know, older people on fixed incomes in one building is that services can access them easily. They can get things that they need. It's, you know, more economical for the services to deliver those services to people who are all in one place. So, yeah, I mean, it is a real shame. It is very disruptive for older people to have to move at all. It's very disruptive for them to think about, you know, if you're 70 or 80, they're going to move you out, they're going to relocate you with a right of return, but are you going to want to move back in 10 years when the you know, new properties are ready?
Yeah.
For a lot of people, it is going to be the permanent loss of the home and community that they've enjoyed.
And where are they going to be dispersed to? I mean, one assumes they'll be all over the place.
Yeah, great question. I'm not so sure about the details of that. I don't think anything's come out, and I'm not so sure what's happened in the other ones. But the Victorian government does have to spend huge amounts of money to find places to put these people, which in many cases is going to be into sort of subletting arrangements or you know, properties that they've bought to move people into.
Mm. And in terms of, with all those costs on top of everything else, the cost of refurbishing would be so much cheaper without tearing them down.
I mean, that does seem to be the case. The Victorian government, I believe, still refused to release its, you know, documents to show how it came to the decision that this was the best approach. There is quite a lot of research suggesting that refurbishing them would be cost-effective and, you know, reasonable in the circumstances and obviously less disruptive. But yeah, the government is determined.
Good heavens. Also, one of our favourite groups, these land lease places, there's been talk that they're likely to start amalgamating and they'll end up with three or four big ones making massive amounts of money. And one of them, Gem Life, run by the Puljich family, said the move to become a listed company was to ensure it could emerge as one of the largest players in a consolidating industry. Gen Life has aggressive aspirational growth ambitions, no doubt about it, he said. So that augurs well for the people they care about putting into homes, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's true that the industry has become more profitable and that means the bigger players are trying to absorb more of the market. One interesting thing that we saw recently is that Eureka, which is a company that I think mainly is based in Queensland, although they have some Victorian locations as well, they are an older person's housing specialist. I think they run some retirement villages and they definitely run some rental villages. They recently acquired, I think it's Benalla Tourist Park, which is another residential park or land lease community. And they've announced that they're going to make it Victoria's first all-ages rental community. So residential parks, you know, they have been older people's accommodation in Victoria. There's no necessary intrinsic reason why that should be the case, you know, why a person of 30 or 40 or whatever couldn't live in that sort of community. It's interesting to see what will become of their plans to sort of open it up to a wider age range.
Yes, it just shows they're expanding and they care about the whole community, not just the older people. See, that's it. Yeah.
Yes, that's definitely what it shows.
Yeah, put little babies in there or something. That'd be great. I've got this bloody cough this morning. Shane, can you do anything about it for me?
Oh, no, but if you're coughing everywhere, I'm glad I'm not in the studio today.
Yeah, that's right. You are lucky. You must have sensed something was happening. Yeah, but in fact, one mob have just bought a 32.5 hectare property, and this is up in Townsville. But it has scope for 500 homes and resort facilities. So they're not small time anymore. These places, are they?
I mean, there's been big residential parks all over for a long time. You know, the Willow Lodge in Dandenong has been around for donkey's years, and that I think that's got about 400 sites. There's definitely some really large parks.
Yeah, and one of them advertised, or not was well, it wasn't a land lease, but one of the residential homes places advertising for us all to move in, advertised that you get it, you can have a year without any fees at all, which is quite extraordinary. Attached to it was a little asterisk, and the asterisk at the bottom said conditions and thing owned terms and conditions apply, and I thought, I'll bet they do. I'm not sure to what degree you'd in fact get a benefit from that, but the terms and conditions always seem to apply in these things.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone's getting fee-free accommodation without any terms or conditions.
No, absolutely. Hang on, you just faded away then, Shane. Are you there?
Oh, yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, you faded away, yeah. Yeah, anything else then before we go?
Well, I guess the other thing that maybe is worth mentioning is that the Victorian Government Consumer Affairs just announced a new Victorian Renters Rights Program. That's going to sort of expand on the existing tenant advice and advocacy programs, which are the sort of local tenant advocacy services all across the state. So it's a big investment. You know, as someone who works in the sector, probably the most exciting part is that it's a five-year program, which is extreme job security by the standards of the community sector. Really happy to see that sort of longer-term funding cycle. It's going to be really good to see more Victorians able to get assistance from these kind of programs because, as I'm sure everyone realises, the demand is overwhelming and a lot of these services just can't keep up at the moment.
Well, that's good news. We might even spend more time on that next month then and go into a bit more detail.
All right.
Okay, look, thanks for that, Shane, and we'll hopefully see you next month. And if you come in, I'll try not to have a cough.
All right, sounds good.
Okay, thanks, mate. Thanks, Shane McGrath there from the Housing Age Action Group. And we'll take a quick break, wander back, and we'll be talking to Melbourne academic Kate Shaw.
One Nation is surging in the polls. March for Australia is on our streets. We urgently need to build an anti-racist movement to counter this wave of hate. That's why the Refugee Action Collective has called a forum at Trades Hall on Wednesday, the 25th of February at 6:30 p.m. We'll hear from refugees and migrants, Jews and Muslims, unionists, Greens and Labor. Together we can resist the racists. Be there. Details on RAC's Facebook page. Refugee Action Collective is a 3CR supporter.
They're eyeing off an estate which is in perfectly good condition. It just happens to have bay views and a lot of open space.
Bay Views for All is a new documentary that reveals the human cost of the Victorian Government's public housing redevelopment project. The film documents residents of the Barrack Beacon public housing estate as they fight to save their homes and community. Bay Views for All is available for community members, public housing advocates, and organisations to screen, intending to spark conversations, raise funds, and educate audiences on the importance of public housing. To organise a screening, email barrackbeacon@gmail.com. That's BARACBEACON @gmail.com.
Save public housing! Stop the demolition!
3CR supporter.
The state Labor government has begun works on demolishing Melbourne's 44 public housing towers to be replaced with private housing. Already hundreds of residents have been displaced, often into unsuitable homes under duress.
The towers on Racecourse Road, Flemington, have become Homes Victoria work sites, while the families still living in the buildings are being treated appallingly.
Join Save Public Housing supporters in solidarity with residents.
Weekdays 7:30 till 9 a.m. as we engage with passing traffic to make some noise and show Jacinta Allen
that the demolition of public housing is unacceptable. Signs and banners provided or bring your own.
There's power in numbers, so see you at 120 Racecourse Road, Flemington, 7:30 till 9 a.m.
Save Public Housing is a 3CR supporter.
Right. Well, so far with Kate Shaw, we're getting messages, but not getting
Kate. We're not sure.
No, that's right. But we'll hopefully she'll call us very shortly. But before we go there, I want to cop the latest edition of the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union Journal, just out, or summer out, has an editorial by the secretary, the union secretary, Steve Murphy, the national secretary, called Housing is for Living, Not for Profit. And he says, we need to talk about housing from a working class point of view, not the one spoon fed to us by the rich and powerful. They want us to believe housing is just another way to get rich. But for us, housing is a basic human right. It's about having a safe, secure place to rest after a long day of work, a place where our families can grow, and a place we can proudly call our own. It's about dignity. Mm. The truth is, the housing market is rigged against us. While we bust our backs to make a living, landlords, property developers and wealthy investors treat housing like a high-stakes poker game. They manipulate supply, jack up prices and dodge taxes to rake in massive profits. And what's left for us? Sky-high mortgages, soul-crushing rent, or a lifetime of being shut out of home ownership entirely. And it goes on and on. And in fact, Kate wrote an article, a feature piece that was published in The Age on New Year's Day of all days, along similar lines, in fact, which we'll talk to her about hopefully
shortly. It seems to be a basic argument. It's a basic conflict of interest, isn't
it? Yes, there is somewhere. Yeah. And what you find interesting is that the same people who say they desperately want to provide affordable housing then get very upset if house prices don't go up.
That's right. So the investor versus the person who needs a roof over their head.
Yes, that's it. And they conclude by saying, to level the playing field, the government must move to abolish negative gearing and all tax concessions that allow investors to outcompete working families, etc. They don't necessarily push for public housing, but we'll forgive them for
to
that.
To start, I mean, it's so hard for people to see that connection between tax law and the fact that you can't afford a home. But the connection is pretty direct, really, even though it took a decade or more to play out and to cause the housing crisis that we've got. And again, I think we can thank Howard for all of that.
Yeah, Johnny, he's done a good job, hasn't he?
He's probably telling us, I told you so.
And the problem is that the Labor Party, when it comes in, doesn't rescind most of what they did.
No, they seem to have trouble with that one.
Yeah, if Labor does anything decent, which is not much, usually when Liberals come in, they wipe it out anyway.
Yes. Why don't Labor have the big eraser? Yeah. Like the big rubber, just rub it all out.
On the week that was this week, I reminded people because we talked about the cost of healthcare and the private health insurance mob, and that Howard directed so much of the what should be public health funding to the private health mob. But when he did that, Kim Beazley, who was the Labor leader, showing incredible courage and guts and everything else, said, look, we totally oppose what he's doing, but if elected, we will not change it. And I thought, there's courage run riot.
Courage run riot. And, the other thing with this whole business of putting the need, like a human need, into a for-profit framework, I mean, the whole thing with that is that I've lost my train of thought.
Oh.
Is that, good. I've got it back
good,
again.
Good.
The tea helps.
I just saw the train shoot into your head.
Oh, I'm having one of those mornings. Is that you basically are splitting the working class and pitting them against each other. So this whole line that we were sold that we needed to, you know, mom and pop needed to invest in their home and buy a second home so that they can set themselves up for their retirement. That's pitting the working class. So that's why Labor are so reluctant to deal with it, because half of their voters are like, well, I don't want to see housing prices go down.
That's right. And whenever they talk about cutting back some of the taxes and perks that investors get, property investors get, it's always they're going to hurt the mum and dad investors when they're a vast minority of the investors who are making fortunes out of real estate. Can I just, by the way, also thank a listener who, Terry, who regularly keeps in contact with us, who sent me that information. He sent me this copy of the AMWU magazine.
Okay.
But he also sent an accompanying letter telling us how wonderful we are, by the way.
Oh, that's nice.
In fact, I think he's a little over the top on that one. But he says he enjoys the program. And he says, he goes on to say, oh, this is what I want to raise, we humankind are in a hell of a mess when you look back to 50s and 60s to the rational, caring future world, both in improved living standards worldwide and international relations with emerging nation states. I would say since the mid-80s, when corporate capitalism started to exert influence and latent control over many economies, standards have deteriorated enormously, etc., etc. And just to Terry, if he's listening, on that last point, there's a very good book by, you may well have read it, in fact, Anne, by Elizabeth Humphreys, a Sydney academic, called How Labor Bought Neoliberal, I think it's called How Labor Bought Neoliberal Capitalism, or How Labor Bought
Neoliberalism's in that title.
Neoliberalism, yeah, that's right. That's How Labor Bought Neoliberalism, I think, or neoliberalism. But certainly, if Terry, if you haven't read it, it's worth getting a hold of a copy and having, because it really exposes the Hawke Keatings, the Kelties, the ACTU, and all those people who were involved in neoliberalism, and of course in the course of that in helping destroy the trade union movement at the time as well to a great degree. So,
yeah, it rewrote history for me. You just sort of assume that the Labor governments were there, you know, fighting for the workers, but no.
No, definitely not.
Mm. Can I recommend another book?
Yes, you can.
Yeah, so Reclaim the State by Bill Mitchell, and he goes into the history of how labor movements around the world, particularly Labor governments, so in the UK and France especially, were instrumental in bringing in some of the first neoliberal thinking into the way they handled their budgets and so how they actually brought in laws, you know, including, what is it, their anti-deficit spending mindsets. Which meant if you don't deficit spend, you can't provide things like public housing.
And we don't. We don't. There's also been there's been some criticism of this 5% deposit program the government has come up with, because it's argued that in that sector where they did raise the amount, the price, the house price you could buy up to $950,000, I think it is, in Victoria. And they also, you know, it was limited to people on certain incomes, and now they've sort of opened it right up. But the argument is that it's in fact having the effect of increasing the prices in that range, because there's more people at the same time trying to buy. And it's also been raised because of the 5% deposit, you end up with a massive loan. And as the recent interest rates went up, increasingly people, you know, the lower income people on that 5% deposit scheme may suddenly find it very, very difficult to meet their repayments.
Just digging a deeper and deeper debt hole.
Yeah. So it's quite a serious problem.
It's a known thing. Like, it is a known thing, Kevin. We can tell them we told them so, because they know that when you introduce a subsidy on anything, and then you don't put a cap on whatever those things are selling for, then all that's going to happen is you're going to raise the prices by whatever that subsidy is. It's a known dynamic.
And, of course, it's a big mistake to to then open it up to everybody, so even the most rich people could get in on that scheme, although they don't really want to, because they don't need it.
Even if you means test it, it's still a problem as a technique for getting people into homes. Hello, let's build some more public housing.
Yes. Oh, good heavens. Good God.
We'd never say that on this show, would we?
Well, in fact, there's also been articles in the last few days. One headline, housing crisis is on land, government's to blame. And the real estate industry is saying, or the property industry is saying, that the government isn't opening enough land, and it's too much, too many taxes on land, and all that's causing the problem.
Yes.
And there's continual argument that if you build more homes, prices will come down. Mm. Now, that argument is in fact refuted quite strongly by Kate in her article in the paper the other day, and says that none of that will work and prices will keep going up as long as we have the sort of attitude to housing that we've currently got in our society.
Hence the taxation issue, you know, that it's incentivise investors and so on.
Yeah, that's right. She goes on to say, the devil is in the detail. The demolished public dwellings will be replaced by community housing units run by not profits but financed by corporate investors who seek returns on those investments. Mm-hmm. Their number will increase by just 10%. No new public housing will be built beyond one federal-funded replacement scheme in Carlton. The remaining two-thirds of the new dwellings will comprise a small component of, quote, affordable housing, renting to 90% of market rate, and much more private market housing. Ooh. The first stage of Sydney's Waterloo Renewal Project will soon demolish the housing of well over 1,000 residents, nearly a quarter of whom have lived there for more than 20 years, and 22% of whom are Indigenous. Again, these will be replaced by community and, quote, affordable housing, and double that number in market rate housing. On completion, the project will have destroyed 2,000 public dwellings. Will any of these actions redress the nation's low-cost housing crisis? You be the judge.
Well, we put that word affordable into quotes, don't we? Because when you're looking at, what was it, 90% of market rates and real, you know, proper public housing, it's like 25% of your income, no matter what your income is. So if you're on some kind of Centrelink payment, you're paying 25% of that. You're not paying 90% of market rates.
No.
So public housing and affordable housing, the difference is
enormous.
Yep.
And even in so-called social housing and community housing, where governments are now putting it and they're not providing any real public housing anymore, there it's usually about 33% of your income. It's argued that if you pay more than 33%, you're really in trouble for housing anyway.
That should go for everyone, shouldn't it?
But they charge more than public housing. Public housing, you know, they take people off the public housing list, but they charge 33% generally. I know some don't, but most do. Whereas 25% is quite affordable for most people.
That's the real definition of affordable.
Right. I mean, if you're on the pension or whatever, which is pretty ordinary, 25% at least you can survive.
That sounds good to me. Well, we have a few minutes left, and I believe Kate is on the line. So I'll just take a quick break and be back with Kate. Was a quick break.
Okay, Kate Shaw is on the line. And Kate, I've just been quoting from an article of yours that was published on New Year's Day, in fact, in The Age. But can you explain to us, we've only got a few minutes left, unfortunately, but can you explain to us?
I'm sorry about that. I was unavoidably delayed.
Right, whatever. In that case, we'll forgive you, but only just. Kate, can you explain to us why you say under the current policies, whatever happens, like the industry says we need more land, we need more affordable housing, therefore prices will come down. You refute that.
Absolutely, I do. We don't need more market housing. We don't need more high-income housing. In fact, not only do we have a lot of middle to high-income housing being constructed, and we can see it all around us, but ABS and Prosper Australia figures show that a lot of this is empty. Prosper Australia is a think tank sort of based on Henry George, sort of George's thinking, and they monitor vacancies, like vacancies that are not available for rent, and show that about 10% of the housing stock is not occupied. Much of this is Airbnb and holiday houses, but there is around 2% that is like just permanently empty. So it's fairly clear that a lot of the construction of high-end housing is investment product, and it doesn't have to be rented. That's not the point of it. The point of it is for people to buy it and have it there as a safety deposit box that they can sell when they need or want to realise the capital gain. What we do need is low-income housing, and the market is not going to provide low-income housing. Only governments can provide low-income housing at scale, and of course that's public housing.
And yet governments in recent years have put all their faith answering what you describe as the housing crisis that really wasn't as such, but nonetheless, they put their faith totally in the private sector.
Yes, indeed. And that's ideological, right? I mean, the funny thing is that Australia is actually kind of slow to the mark. European countries and the UK are realising that neoliberalism is not a great experiment. And there is talk of renationalising a whole lot of services in Berlin. As you know, there is a big campaign to expropriate privatised social housing companies, or social housing companies now. They were, in effect, they were state-owned, and then they were sold. It was a bad move. We can see it, you know. We can see it in childcare, education, aged care. Privatisation, great success, wasn't it? And, you know, not to mention water and electricity and gas and everything else. I mean, the world is coming to terms with the fact that the neoliberal project was a bad project, that it increases inequalities. But our state and federal governments are just, you know, just a bit slow off the mark. So they're still committed to privatising everything, and that's why we've got the disastrous situation that we have in Victoria of the proposed demolition of the towers and the government pressing ahead hell-bent in the face of all of the arguments, strong arguments as to why they should not, because they don't care about those arguments. It's ideological. They don't want to be in the business of providing social and public services.
Indeed, you know, we know they did for a long, long time. We've got about 1 minute, but what do you think has made them change their position on that in terms of providing those services?
Ideology. You know, it started under Thatcher and Nixon in the 80s, and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the EU. I mean, it's very. You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to be very clear about the economic pressures on governments.
Yeah, so they've just adopted the neoliberal philosophy, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so the philosophy is hand housing over to the market, with the not-for-profit private sector as this, you know, kind of little sweetener. You know, we'll stick that in there to, you know, to have a little bit of.
All right, Kate, we're going to have to do this again, Kate, and hope you answer the phone because we run out of time. But look, thanks for your time this morning and thanks for your limited time this morning. Okay, Kate, we'll catch up. Okay, thanks a lot.
Goodbye.
Rightio, that's City Limits for the week. Joe's coming up, and next week we've got David Spratt talking about climate change. And I think those who know David know he's wonderful. He's not wonderful, but he certainly knows his stuff.